And we are back. Carmine, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Back are we for the second part of the G-Steph Cushing Library, Secrets of the Cushing Library. so he combined the Clash of Kings and Storm of Sword drafts together. But for this one, we're just going to tackle Clash of Kings.
Yeah, yeah. The ACOG. Yes.
By the way, before you continue on, I forgot to tell you, there was actually another person who went to the Cushing Library that we briefly talked about. Some person named Honeybee, I think it was. And I'll have to show you this later. I we did this like over a year ago, and I always thought it was just G-Steph, but no, it was another person. I think they were Honeybee. But they just found out a couple of minor things. And the other thing I wanted to get out of the way is, we had this discussion privately, and I know the audience is going to ask, what about the Dance of Dragons drafts? You were telling me how G-Steph combined it together with the Feast, because Feast was originally one book and George
had combined them. I mean, he didn't know he was going to split the books until he was, you know, a good 800 manuscript pages in, you know, and then and then split out the dance portion and then continued to just finish Feast. He thought it was going to be one book. And then other stuff like related to dance as it went further is I think it might be locked up and not released until Winds of Winter is out or something. There are things at the Cushing Library that are not accessible to the public.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know that part, actually. When we eventually finish all the drafts, the Game of Thrones, we already did Clash of Kings and Storm of Swords, we're going to have G-Steph on and just ask him some questions, shoot the shit with him. So,
yeah, sure thing. So let's get into it. A Clash of Kings. So this is what G-Steph says. He says, welcome to part two of my 2024 series. So his first thing, he says, A Clash of Kings, the glass candles. Now, this is probably the juiciest thing I would say he found in the entire trip. The Cushing Library contains one draft of A Clash of Kings, essentially from June 1997. The book was published in 98. There's another final draft with no substantial changes. This draft had 31 chapters, 567 manuscript pages, roughly 48% of the final text. You can see the chapter structure. Sadly, it doesn't include the most important chapter for foreshadowing Dany's vision of the House of the Undying. But he felt that the most interesting change was a Clash of King draft relates to something that was hinted at in the A Feast for Crows prologue, and that George has been wrestling with how to introduce the glass candles. And he was thinking about introducing them long before Feast was published. So what we're talking about here is in A Feast for Crows, at the in the prologue, Lazy Leo mentions that a glass candle is burning in Archmaester Marwyn's chambers. And then at the end of the book, in Sam 5, the final chapter of A Feast for Crows, Sam goes up to those chambers, he sees the glass candle, and he actually stares into it and loses time. And so, and then in A Dance with Dragons, we have Quaithe kind of visits Dany, and she claims that the glass candles are burning. So we're thinking that, she's using one. But the glass candles are essentially a device that allows communication over a distance, where you can enter someone's dream, and or at least that's how we understand it currently in the story. But they mention other things, that there's four glass candles in the world, and there's some suspicion that perhaps Maester Aemon was getting glass candled by someone on his trip back. And then we start thinking of all the different dreams that people have in the series, and whether or not a glass candle is the reason that they are getting interfered with.
Were you the one that said the glass candles can be used to also like make projections?
Well, I mean, what it's hard to say what the projection is. Like when Danny sees Quaithe in A Dance with Dragons, is Quaithe physically there or is Danny unconscious? Is Danny the only one seeing it or not? Danny's the only one there, so it's hard to really say.
Mm-hmm.
I think personally that it's all in somebody's head. I don't think that there's any physical manifestation myself or any projection, but I think there people are sending their consciousness across and into somebody else's mind.
I'm sure the connection has been made before between this, the glass candles in Ice and Fire, and the Palantir in Lord of the Rings. You remember the Palantir?
Yes.
The crystal ball that, yeah.
Yeah. And obviously the glass candles are also a parallel to the weirwood nets. They're just the fire version of it or something, you know? So you have your ice version and you have your fire version.
Just like the whites.
Yeah, yeah. So like people enter the weirwood net and they can enter people's dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Across a distance, and people enter the glass candle and they can enter people's dreams across a distance. So originally in the Clash of Kings, we know there's only one mention of the glass candles. It's the first mention of the glass candles, but Dany is in Karth and she hears that Urathon Nightwalker has been using glass candles. That's all we kind of hear about it. But apparently there was many more glass candles in this original draft of A Clash of Kings. So G-Steph says, there's no new lore here, just stuff that eventually made it into Feast. But it's interesting that George tried to make the ignition of glass candles coincide with the arrival of the Red Comet. A few pages later, he seems to connect them more directly. There's a passage in the published version of this chapter where Crescent thinks about the comet before going to bed. Originally, it read like this. Yet when he closed his eyes, he could see the pale bright flame of the glass candle burning steadily against the inside of his eyelids. As he watched, it grew into the comet, red and fiery and vividly alive amidst the darkness of his dreams. There's also a deleted line after he wakes up about him having had dark, terrible dreams, perhaps somehow prompted by the glass candle. And after he falls and Melisandre helps him up at the feast, Crescent has this deleted thought. She knows why the glass candle burns, what the comet pretends. She is wiser than you, old man. In retrospect, the last line of this chapter was originally written as a callback to Crescent's ominous glass candle. Here is the published version. As the cowbells pealed in the antlers, singing fool, 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 while the red woman looked down upon him in pity, the candle flames danced in her red, red eyes. So that's the published version of A Clash of Kings. And hold on a sec. I'm going to go to just making sure that what am I doing here, man? A search. But what he's saying, I'm just making sure that's the last line. Yeah, that's it. Crescent tried to reply, but the words were caught in his throat. His cough became a terrible thin whistle as he strained and sucked in air. Iron fingers tightened around his neck. As he sank to his knees, he shook his head, denying her power, denying her magic, denying her god. And the cowbells pealed in the antlers, singing fool, 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 while the red woman looked down upon him in pity, the candle flames dancing in her red, red eyes. So that's a remnant. But it's still, you know, she still thought it was worth putting in there because it still sounded pretty. But originally, it had a double meaning or the candle flames were glass candle flames in her red, red eyes. So it's a pretty big plot point that every single maester now has a working glass candle.
So in the published version, there's only a few of them, but in the original drafts, everybody had one.
Yeah. So what we find here is that like later in the Tyrion chapter, Tyrion runs into Pycelle, and Pycelle's glass candle has ignited. Behind the shelves, hidden in an ornate lacquer screen, he stumbled on a tiny windowless alcove where a tall black candle was burning atop a carved marble shelf. Something about it made Tyrion want to examine it more closely, and then he knew he was running short on time. He made a hasty retreat back to the table and was peeling another egg when Grand Maester Pycelle came creeping back down the stair. And then he says, "Lord, please, please, you must heed me. You are in danger, all of you, grave danger. The realm, there's so much you do not know. Secrets, the hidden mysteries. The glass candle is burning. It's true, I swear. Spare me, and I'll show you the conclave. You must send me to Old Town at once." So, and then apparently through the rest of Clash of Kings, there's just all these references to the maesters disappearing and all going to Old Town.
All the maesters, all over Westeros, all of them.
Yes. With the exception of Lewin.
poor Maester Lewin.
Right. But there is a weird, and I noticed this. In fact, when we had our conversation with G-Steph, I sort of said, yeah, there's this one line that from Clash where Theon goes home and he asks about the maester, and it's such a weird inserted line that it struck me, you know, because we never hear about Theon like liking maesters or whatever, and you know, there's a million people at home that you could ask about. You could ask about the cook, you could ask about the smith, you could ask about a wet nurse, you could ask about, you know, a handmaid. But he like goes home and he's like, "Oh, where's the maester?" You know, and the line always stuck out to me. And it turns out when I asked G stuff about it, he's like, actually, that's one of the remnant lines. So he says, you know, he says, "Wendemir keeps the ravens now." Before he's like, "Oh, where's Wendemir?" And they're like, "Wendemir's dead." But now he's like, "He sleeps in the sea. Wendemir keeps the ravens now." And then the added on thing, but he's gone south to Old Town on some maester's business. You know, so like the original, I think, is just he sleeps on the sea, Wendemir keeps the ravens now, you know.
So this was like, I wouldn't say it's a major plot point, but it was a plot point brewing behind the scenes. And clearly all the point of view characters were starting to get cued in that something's going on with Theon and here with Bran. You mind if I read this?
Sure.
With Bran, Bran is listening to petitioners at Winterfell in Bran 2. There's this altered description of Leobald Tallheart's visit. Quote, he talked of weather portents and the lax wits of small folks for what seemed like hours, complained that his maester had left them to visit the Citadel, and told how his nephew, Benfred, itched for battle. So, yeah, this is also something I brought up in our conversation with G-Steph. It's kind of crazy that all the maesters in all of Westeros, except Lewin, went down to the Citadel. They left their post for this gigantic meeting in Old Town, which, and we were talking about this briefly as well, that's kind of insane that, like, the entire realm's scientists, doctors, teachers all get up and leave just to go do this one thing. So,
yeah. And it's very clear that George has been playing around with, I mean, here the magnitude of how many glass candles there are. But he's been playing around with what the abilities of the glass candles are, too. In the original prologue draft, Pate is not trading a key with Jaq and Hagar. He's trading a glass candle with Jaq and Hagar. The entire, like, iron for gold is glass for gold in the original. George was playing around with the user of the glass candle gained immortality. Yeah. That doesn't seem to be the case in this Clash draft, but in the original Feast draft, it was that the glass candles also granted the user immortality, mirroring the Weirwood again, because the Weirwood grants people immortality, right? You live in that Weirwood forever. But this idea of, like, the Weirwood granting immortality, and you start thinking about, like, Euron's mission of of what if we can all fly? Like, what if we can all be these, like, this, we can all be our own heaven, our own religion, our own God, and live forever, you know, if he had access to a glass candle, if he's Urathon, what, you know, Nightwalker and all sorts of things. You know, because actually they Euron's not supposed to have aged, right? He comes back and he looks the same, you know, or like Melisandre, like she doesn't age, right? So there's like these elements of immortality linked with like objects. And so the idea is that, you know, the glass candles would be like the weirwoods and grant immortality. But it doesn't seem that George has added that and then taken away that ability with the in A Clash of Kings.
I don't think you and I ever really discussed it, but Melisandre in the show, the fact that she hasn't aged is like quickly answered. Apparently it's this thing in her necklace.
And it's just all glamored, yeah.
It's all glamour. So you think that there's something to that? Because the moment she kind of like takes it off after the Battle of Winterfell in season 8.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think George has thought about that. There's definitely some weird lines about how long she's lived and how long she's studied. You know, I think she says something about years beyond count or something, that she's studied something years beyond count, which... You know, maybe she can't count very high, but I think beyond count. Yeah, Melisandre had practiced her art for years beyond count, and she had paid the price. There was no one in her order who had the skill of seeing the secrets half revealed and half concealed within the sacred flames. So. You know, there's this hint that she's actually super old. You know, but she doesn't seem to have a glass candle, but she has flames, which kind of do the same thing as glass candles, you know? You can go and see things from afar, maybe go into people's dreams. Anyway, evidently in this draft, the Citadel quickly became aware of the glass candles were burning, considered a big deal. According to Pycelle, they put the realm in grave danger. And so they called a conclave to discuss the ramifications. This is different from how they're treated in A Feast for Crows. There, Marwyn seems to be the only maester aware that they now work again. And, you know, in some of the early drafts, like, Marwyn has rather public, like, arguments with the other maesters. But again, that's all... Kind of
isn't that like the shifting. Like the main thing about Ice and Fire, though, about the story, is how they're like there's this impending danger that no one seems to care about or just they gloss it over, and there's only that one, maybe one or two people who really know what's going on. Isn't that the whole thing?
That's true, and then nothing seems to be, and then nothing seems to happen for books and books and books. Yeah, definitely. Nearly all of this was deleted, but remember that George did retain one mention of the glass candles in Clash, where Zaro tells about the strange magical phenomenon. And so it was then, but how? It is said that the glass candles are burning in the house of Urathon Nightwalker that have not burned in 100 years. Yeah, so what does it all mean? Well, here's my guess. Although he really liked the glass candle concept, George, probably with his editors, decided that as magical omens, the candles and the comet were redundant, and that the book was getting too long as it was, so he deleted the candles and the conclave subplot from Clash, but with an eye toward coming back to it later, he left that single reference from Zaro as part of the general catalog of weirdness without the original Citadel connection. This was George planting a seed, while strategically keeping things vague, given the trouble he had trying to make the original glass candle concept work.
I agree with that. That seems like what it... Either that or he forgot, but...
It's like anything else. Like for instance, the rats chewing off their own tail, like, that doesn't mean... You know, he leaves it so ambiguous that had he never brought this up again, glass candles burning in the house of Arathon Nightwalker, and then decided to like drop it completely, he could drop it. And we would just have it as a random freaking thing that happened in Karth, like rats chewing off their tail. But he did bring it back. So now, you know, it's significant. But he could have, he kicked the can down the street and he did come back to it in Feast. But, you know, this was just kicking the can down the Feast. Like him leaving one glass candle reference is fairly meaningless.
By the way, Urathon Nightwalker, are you coming back to that guy?
Well, Urathon Nightwalker is kind of funny. Many people, because later we hear about Uragon, and maybe in a World of Ice and Fire there's an Urathon. It's a Ironborn name. I think, you know what it is? In A World of Ice and Fire, they reference the same guy, but I think they call him Urathon once and Uragon another time. Urathon Good Brother? Urathon Good Brother? But I think Urathon Good Brother is called Uragon Good Brother in the text of A Dance with Dragons. So, yeah, it is. So, Uragon the third, Uragon the fourth. So it definitely sounds like, you know, it sounds like an Ironborn name. And we know that Uron sounds like Urathon to start with, but Urathon sounds like a Ironborn name. It seems to be an Ironborn name in the World of Ice and Fire, Uragon. We know that Euron was near Karth around the time Dany was, because he picks up the warlocks and he has the warlocks. So Euron being Urathon Nightwalker is not much of a stretch. You know, he could easily be him if you wanted him to be. Because Euron was in that area, and Euron seems to be somebody's been going into Aeron Damphair's head, and maybe it's Euron. So, you know, you throw all these things together, you're like, yeah, your Urathon Nightwalker could easily be Euron, you know?
I feel like I've heard that theory before. Out of all the Euron Greyjoy theories, you know, him being Benjen or him being Daario, I kind of like this one the most. I feel like I've heard this one before, but possibly not. Also, Urathon being in the World of Ice and Fire, was that Elio and Lindo or was that George? I hate to be that person that always asks, because I do know that Elio and Lindo came in and they did do their own thing with that. So I'm wondering if that's George, then there it is. But if it's Elio and Lindo, then take it with a grain of salt.
Right. It depends if it's an aside. Let's see. Urathon Good Brother. And then there's an Urathon Peak. Urathon Good Brother, the Bad Brother. And then it says N1. In A Dance with Dragons, Urathon is called Uragon Good Brother, where in the World of Ice and Fire, they call him Urathon. It has been suggested. It has been suggested to change the spelling in A Dance with Dragons instead of the World of Ice and Fire, making Urathon the correct spelling. It sounds like George went and put Urathon in the World of Ice and Fire, and they went back and asked him, and then he somehow he's like, oh, sorry, Uragon is a misspelling.
Okay.
Here's actually Linda talking about it. Uragon, this one should have been fixed years ago. Correction on this. Something about this niggled at me, and I checked through my emails again and see the reason it wasn't fixed is that there was a notion of perhaps adjusting A Dance with Dragons instead of The World of Ice and Fire. I don't know the status of that. So it sounds like they at least asked him about it, but you know, that it wasn't Elio and Linda, that it was George. Once Clash was done, George had a huge set of fully developed plans for Storm and had no room to introduce anything else in that book. But once Clash shot to the top of the bestsellers list and A Song of Ice and Fire started to become a big deal in the publishing world, he decided to take his time on the next book and include all the stuff he wanted to include in the previous books but hadn't had time for, including the Citadel and the Ironborn plots, which are basically the first two things he worked on for Feast. You know, it's hard to say on this. I don't know if he's like intentionally taking his time. But I do get a sense that George had realized that this was, and a lot of writers do this. They realized this was a cash cow and decided to stretch out the series. I mean, Charles Dickens did this, but certainly Robert Jordan talked about doing this, that like, oh, this is my income. I better put out I don't want to finish this up too fast.
Well, props to Robert Jordan for actually being honest about that. He gets my respect for that, because I hate when people try to bullshit their way out of that, because it's very clear. Like, look, you know, if you enjoy writing stories and you want to keep making that money. But I feel like it's a bit of both with George. Like, obviously, you know, he wanted to make his money and he had all these ideas he wanted to put in and couldn't before in the second book. But yeah, Here's the third one. So
people were certainly surprised with Feast going in a completely utter different direction. And what does this mean for the story? Given that the glass candle material was specifically deleted and then replaced with other glass candle material in A Feast for Crows, I don't think we can read much into it. But if I had to draw conclusions, it would be these. George originally meant for both the candles and the comet to have been triggered by the return of magic, or perhaps just fire magic in the world, which in turn was prompted by the birth of dragons. This isn't a novel theory, but the more explicit candle timing and candle comet prose linkage in the draft Clash prologue suggests George considered them all connected. Certainly all connected. I think there's a causation issue and problem, right? Like, is the comet causing the dragons, which is causing the candles, which is causing the wildfire? Because remember the wildfire discussion in A Clash of Kings where the wisdom is like, are there any dragons around? We produced more wildfire than we thought. Are there any dragons around? And Tyrion's like, what the fuck are you talking about? So there's definitely a return of magic like element that we're supposed to think about, right? And I don't know the causation. You know, is it the dragons causing the comet? Is it the dragons causing the we don't think about anything causing the comet, right? We think of the comet being independent. It's hard to believe that the dragons would pull a comet in. So maybe the comet caused everything. I don't know.
I always thought, in my opinion, I always thought the comet just amplified the dwindling magic in the world. That magic will dwindle every now and then. It'll go away, and then some event like this will come, and it will flare the fuck up.
Right. So, I mean, you're on board with essentially, not literally, but thematically, comet is a Vulcan. That like,
is that, you know, what it is? I'll take it.
The Vulcan enhances people's like telepathic and telekinetic abilities when it's near. Right. So like, if the comet is a Vulcan, the comet is enhancing magic. Or, you know, or maybe telepathic, telekinetic abilities, you know, when it's near. That's it. And then he said that he thought that he wanted Pycelle at the Citadel and the Citadel to be freaked out by this, because the Citadel had a hand in the elimination of dragons and thus magic from the world roughly 151 years ago. Yeah, you know, I think that's fair. I mean, that same connection is being made in A Feast for Crows. So, you know, they're linking the Citadel and dragons and magic together as some sort of event. But really, the material is 27 years old at this point. It's interesting, but whatever plans George had for the Glass Candles and the Citadel then have been overtaken by later books. That's true. And then, okay. Anyway, anything more you want to talk about Glass Candles, or do you want to move on to Cersei's Mole?
I really wanted to know, like, what the plan was for the Glass Candles going forward in the original draft.
I mean, if I were to guess about the Glass Candle, and I think, you know, I push the fan fiction in this direction, that George loves the idea of the all-powerful shut-in, this person that's in a room that has power over all sorts of things in the realm. I think Sam is positioned to be like Bran, where he is sitting in front of a glass candle, seeing the world, sending himself out, affecting change in his environment. And keep in mind that the Citadel is very similar to the Weirwood, where, you know, you have all of this knowledge. The Weirwood has it within the trees, but the Citadel has it within books. You have all of this knowledge, and then you have a character who can, from their little, you know, immobile place, can affect change in the entire world. And so I think you have, you know, these twin kind of ideas, one of ice and one of fire. And, you know, he may have cut the idea that the glass candles have immortality, but I don't necessarily think it's that important, you know? I don't know. That's kind of how I see it going forward. And you know, maybe it relates to Euron, about Euron wanting to create his own House of the Undying, or his own religious network of minds that would continue on forever, like the Weirwood Net. But that would be my guess. You know, that it's something that it's just. At the end of the day, another weirwood is what it is. It's just a fire weirwood.
Hmm.
Would be my guess.
By the way, earlier we mentioned fire white. That's not in the books, but that's something that George said. I remember George
said, yeah.
Yeah, him talking about that specifically, in case people were confused by that. He called Jon a fire white.
Yeah, which means you'd assume that, like, Lady Stoneheart and Beric Dondarrion or whatever, or Fire Whites or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cersei's Mole.
Cersei's Mole. So this is, like, kind of a random scene. The second interesting set of changes in the draft of Clash relates to Tyrion's attempt in Clash of Kings Tyrion 4 to flesh out the identity of Cersei's informant by feeding Pycelle, Littlefinger, and Varys three different stories about his plans for Cersei's children and seeing which story Cersei learns about. There are some key differences in the draft that may change your understanding, but here's what happened canonically. But this change is a bit tricky, so before getting into it, recall these details from the published version. Yeah, so Tyrion meets Pycelle in his chambers, gives Pycelle two letters containing duplicate copies of an offer to foster Mycella with Prince Doran, and instructs Pycelle to send both letters via Raven immediately. This is, he tells him that, like, he wants to send two because in case one gets lost. But really the reason he gave two is because Pycelle would go, well, I can just send one and then send, give the other message to Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
While waiting for Pycelle to return, Tyrion hears wings and then sees one raven fly from the rookery. Varys arrives at Tyrion's bedchamber roughly an hour later and already knows that Pycelle just sent a secret letter to Doran on Tyrion's behalf. Cersei later is angry at Tyrion for offering Marcella to Doran, but not for the other offers he described to Littlefinger and Varys. Tyrion ambushes Pycelle with Shaga, accuses him of giving one of the letters to Cersei. Pycelle denies it, accuses Varys. then, after harsher threats, admits to letting John Aaron die. So, most people read this and don't question that Pycelle was Cersei's mole. It just seems logical that Pycelle was Cersei's mole. He's pro Lannister, so it just goes without saying. But you could read into these events and say that maybe Tyrion just didn't see the other raven, or missed it, and Pycelle didn't inform Cersei. Varys did, and it was pinned on Pycelle, and Pycelle was actually like not Cersei's mole. The significance of Varys being Cersei's mole is not that much. I mean, like, Varys disappears later and it doesn't matter. Okay, so in the draft version, Tyrion sees two ravens go. Here's the differences. Tyrion notices two ravens leaving the rookery. Technically in the draft, he saw one but heard two. Varys arrives minutes after Littlefinger leaves rather than a little under an hour. Varys originally denied knowledge of the substance of Doran's letter and instead claims to guess its content rather than saying that his little birds told him. So what's the significance of this? He says, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. My best guess is that George wanted to subtly indicate that Varys was the real leaker, having Tyrion notice two ravens leaving, as he almost subconsciously does in the draft. He undermines his theory that Pycelle kept one of the ravens back. Having Varys appear so quickly when summoned in the draft also may have meant as a hint that he was nearby listening to Tyrion's conversations. There's also a connection to the glass candles changes that makes me think of that, at least in the draft. George meant for Pycelle to have been fully honest when interrogated by Tyrion, and Tyrion didn't realize it. The chapter in which Tyrion interrogates Pycelle about the leak also contains the deleted passage in which Pycelle warns that the glass candles are burning and the realm is in grave danger. Tyrion blows that warning off. At the end of the chapter, he notices that the glass candle Pycelle was talking about again and cheekily extinguishes it. We know from other drafts, chapters, and future books that the glass candles are real and significant, so Tyrion's reaction here is meant to be misguided. When you combine it with the fact that Pycelle denies being the leaker, blaming Varys instead, and that Pycelle quickly admits to a number of other crimes, I think that the draft chapter, Tyrion meant to be mistaken about Pycelle, and that he's been played by Varys. George's decision to go from Tyrion noticing two ravens to noticing one and increasing the amount of time between Varys arriving might indicate that he wanted to drop the idea just to make Pycelle the leaker in the published version, but I personally think Varys could still be the candidate there too. I would say that Varys is the leaker.
Even in the published version?
In the published version. Not that it has any consequences, but Pycelle is unusually honest. Like, he admits to letting a man die. Like, he, you know, it's over the top, and yet he still denies being the leaker to Cersei, you know. So like it doesn't really make sense that he would admit to this greater crime and not the lesser crime. You know, we also look at, like, Pycelle and Cersei's relationship in A Feast for Crows is rather strained. Like, she doesn't trust the guy at all. And that doesn't really make sense if he's been leaking to her in A Clash of Kings, you know?
That's a good point, yeah.
So, but then again, like, it's not like Cersei thinks about Varys very much in A Feast for Crows when she's like, oh, you know, I really needed him. But it's...
Varys being everyone's friend seems more like the role for Littlefinger, that he be the one doing this instead of Varys. I don't know. I like Varys trying to play all sides, but at the same time, yeah, that's how he destabilizes the realm for the Blackfyres.
It's just because we also know that Varys is in the walls, so he can find out all of this information anyway, and he has little birds everywhere. So it's so easy for him to take on that role. But like I say, it doesn't affect the plot at all.
Mm-hmm.
So here,
and I know someone's going to ask me this later. Yes, Varys working for the Blackfyres. Someone was trying to tell me a theory about how Varys himself may be a secret Blackfyre. That's why he shaves his head. I kind of like theory.
I do. I like it. It's a good theory. You know, it's certainly fun. It or just a secret Targaryen of some sort, secret anything. You know, and that's why he shaves his head. But I also think he has nuts. I also think he has his testicles. So
because of that one line where, well, who was it that noticed that he had some
I think it's also mentioned because maybe Ned mentioned meets Rugen, his Rugen the Jailer persona in a Game of Thrones.
I'll take Varys having balls over him being a merman. I'll take that one.
Anyway, the removal of the glass candles is the only significant change to the plot, but there's a bunch of small changes. When Jojen and Mira meet Bran, there's a deleted line where Jojen approaches Summer and says, "Go careful, Jojen. Remember what father said." It's not much. There's another deleted passage. Well, he says it's not much, but given how much speculation about the current status of Howland Reed, this at least provides indication that Howland was at home in the Neck at the beginning of Clash. A variety of characters have tried to contact him, but there's no reports on where he is. So at least he's supposed to be there. At least in this version. There's another deleted Bran passage one chapter earlier in which Bran wants to ride Dancer into the Great Hall for the Harvest Feast, but Maester Luwin refuses, saying it would be unseemly. The chapter ends with this line from Roderick: You have stark pride, Bran, but the Maester has the right of it. I think riding through the Great Hall, no, we will carry you in. With all dignity and honor, believe me, boy, it will be best that way. But riding Dancer into the Great Hall for the feast to hearty cheers for the guests is exactly how Bran's next chapter begins in both the draft and the published book. So the published version loses a bit of context from the draft. It's implied that Bran must have put his foot down and gotten his way and had been proven right. That's true. They're all telling him not to do it.
For non-book readers who are confused, Dancer is the horse that Bran, yeah. So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, we're never, he just rides in and we're like, oh, that's an interesting idea. But here we find out there's the idea and everybody's like, don't do it. And he does it anyway. And that tells you, you know, that's a complete, it's a big deal, right? You know, that everybody's telling him not to do something and he does it anyway. Big personality shift. Here's an interesting one. This is really interesting. I'm surprised this didn't get more, but another interesting change comes from the end of Daenerys 2 when she sends Jorah to the docks of Qarth looking for ships. As published, Jorah returns with K'Hura Moe, the captain of the Cinnamon Wind, who informs Dany of the death of Robert Baratheon. Originally, John intended for Jorah to return with Dario Naharis.
Mm.
Yes. This is an interesting one because it has his descriptions of what Dario looks like. He says, "What would you have of me, Dario Naharis, instead of K'Hura Moe? Nothing but the honor of serving you, my queen, and the joy of watching your face shine with delight when you hear what I shall tell you." "Get on with it, Tyrosh," Ser Jorah growled. Her grace has no taste for hints and feints. "As you will, Dragon Mother Stormborn, fairest of queens, hear my tidings. Robert Baratheon is dead." Outside her walls, dusk was settling. Dead. In her lap, black dragon hissed and pale smoke rose. "Are you certain the usurper is dead?" "Dead and buried, your grace." A golden tooth gleamed in his mouth when he smiled. "When we set sail from Tyrosh, many moons turned past. The talk was of nothing else. The gods are just." So yeah, like at least as far back as A Clash of Kings, Jorah had this character, Dario Naharis, in mind and what he looked like. Like, he was a Tairashi with a golden tooth and all of that, you know, and super overly devoted to Dany. But any sort of weird niceness that we get from Gahuro Mo is seems to be a remnant of him being Dario Naharis. Because Gahuro Mo doesn't really act like that with Sam. You know, he doesn't have the same personality at all.
So Dario was always intended to be... Either George really liked the character and he wanted to save him to have a bigger importance and introduce him with... Then why introduce him with the sellsword company?
Yeah, I mean, was he supposed to be the person that she was going to get on a ship with? And then you don't have to meet him in Slaver's Bay. He's already the ship's captain. I mean, I would say that that Grolio is kind of I would say that it's really weird for Illyrio to get Grolio all the way to Karth. But if you're going to eliminate Grolio, yeah, you're eliminating Barristan, and you're not going to not have Barristan like arrive with Dany. That seems like a major, major plot point. So I don't know why she would be running into Dario in Karth if she's not going to take his ship.
This is to say, this is the same Dario, the same character that we'd get in the published version. And just not
right.
Just
did he just look
swap.
At this character and go, "Oh, I kind of like this character. That's who Dany is going to be boning later." And I
taking her every which way.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Like, did he still want Dany to meet and bone someone in Slaver's Bay? It's just that he had this character that he fleshed out in Karth, and he's like, "Damn, yeah, I'll just use this one," and then swapped him out for Gahuro Mo. Anyway, this is yeah, in this version, he swears himself to Dany immediately, and Stormy only does this on the second meeting. So I guess he swears himself immediately and then follows Dany. I would imagine that George's plan was that Grolio and Barristan would arrive and Dario would still just be in her service.
Right.
And on then along for the ride with his ships behind her or something in tow. I don't know. Yeah, she invites him to dinner so she can hear his tales of his voyage from Tyrosh. So she's getting to know him in Karth. And then the deletion wasn't done for space, doesn't make a ton of sense for a Tyrashi sellsword in Karth to be the person bringing Dany the news from Westeros. I suspect that George originally introduced him in this chapter because he wanted to emphasize the pattern of Jorah warning Dany not to trust anyone. I mean, I think personally he wanted to introduce her next romantic interest, but it just didn't really work to have him be introduced at that point. You know, it makes more sense to, you know, in Slaver's Bay. Right. I suspect Jorah originally introduced him as a character because he wanted to emphasize the pattern. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the news works just as well. I mean, I'm trying to think about this, like the news of Robert Baratheon dying, it being in Tyrosh, like Tyrosh isn't that far from Westeros. So yeah, he could hear about the news and then he would bring the news to Karth. It's not that different than Gahuro Mo being in Old Town. It's not significant. Like the news location of Tyrosh and Old Town, it's not that different. There's only one substantial deleted passage from the John chapters, a flashback to a conversation with Sam, Gren, and Pip before he left on the Great Ranging. Pip offered to trade places with Sam, But Gren says that the deception would never work. Well, obviously. There is another, I mean, it's weird though, right? Because Gren's the stupid one. Why is Pip making that? It should be the other way around, really. Like, the Gren would be like, I'll swap with you. Because Gren's the dumb one, right? Anyway, this is another likely brevity deletion. Adds nothing to the story. Save George 2/3 of a page. There's one small deletion from another John chapter that likely does have story significance. A conversation between John and Mormont about Maester Aemon's biography early in John 1. The draft contains this deleted exchange. The old bear gave a loud snort and the raven took flight, flapping in a circle about the room. If I had a man for every vow I've seen broken in my day, the wall would not lack for defenders, I promise you, especially when it might have been you, John. You are the elder, are you not? By a few turns of the moon, but Rob is trueborn. That is what he shares with Maester Aemon. So one of the ambiguous things is that we don't know who's older, John or Rob. John looks older, but it would only make sense if John were younger, because Ned is married, not necessarily at the beginning of the war, but at the beginning of his participation in the war. So, and he fathers Rob on Catelyn at, you know, right after the Battle of the Bells. So he's, you know, Rob needs, and then the story is that Ned went off and was warring and then, you know, had sex with somebody else. So logically speaking, John should be younger, but John looks older. And here we find out that John claims he is older, but if John's older, then the entire story of him being Ned's bastard falls apart.
That makes sense.
You know, so, you know, they would have to, he would have to delete it. But yeah, I mean, G-Stuff says the Sam published books have no indication whether John or Rob is older, but if John is older, then the story of Ned fathering him makes in Robert's Rebellion makes it impossible. Yes. And the... the same passage also makes one small change to Maester Aemon's biography. As published, he chose to go to the wall to avoid undermining his younger brother. In the original draft, Aegon was the one who sent him there to avoid being compared to Aemon. The published version makes Aemon more noble and Aegon and Egg more of a douche. Sending his brother away to the wall doesn't sound like Egg at all. The clash draft chapters have a deleted connection between John and Arya. There's a deleted line near the end of Arya 3 where she thinks of John while falling asleep. When Arya's eyes finally closed, it seemed as though her brother John was with her. He smiled at her, but something in his eyes looked sad, and she knew he had something important to tell her. They said it together. Winter is coming.
Aww.
Aww, the half siblings that want to bang.
I mean, I didn't want to say that, but okay.
Well, I mean, that was the original plan, right?
Yeah. The triangle with her, Tyrion, and Jon, yeah.
Interestingly, the next chapter is Jon 3. Its end has a deleted mention of John thinking of Arya. Suddenly he remembered how he used to muss Arya's hair, his little stick of a sister. He wondered where she was now. It made him a little sad to think he would never muss her hair again.
Aw, sibling love. Not in that way, but sibling love.
I mean, yeah, I mean, muss her hair. Why are we... Is that the reference to Musser hair? Anyway, we know what Jon Snow is good at. Ygritte tells us what Jon's good at. So
Jesus.
George was clearly setting up the two of them to have an intersection again. The fact that he deleted the passages and that three books later it still hasn't happened may indicate that he changed his mind. In the Sansa chapters, we have some small changes where her dialogue with Dantos about escaping. Originally, Dantos planned for something else to roast someone else to roast Sansa out to sea during the escape. Taking from the castle, it would be the hardest. Once you're out, I know a lad with a little skiff. For a bit of coin and a taste of wine, he'd row you out to sea. These are fisher folk, I know. He's a mute. So he asks no questions and he gives no answers. A mute. Icy needles scraped up Sansa's spine. The king's justice was mute, and the very sight of Sir Ilyn filled her with dread. When would this be? Could we go now? This very night? No, my lady, I fear not. First, I must speak to my friends and find a sure way to get you from the castle when the hour is ripe. It will not be easy nor quick. They watch me as well. As you can see, Dantos also hinted that someone else was directing the plan when he said he was in need of his friends, Littlefinger. Although another deleted line, there's no other hints of who this mute might be, but evidently it was an abandoned subplot. Yeah, I mean, another mute. I mean, everyone, like the fans would just be like, another a little bird? What's going on? You know, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Not much to that, but okay. And some other quick hits. Dany's dragon Rhaegal was originally named Rhaegor. Sir Gregor's torturer the Tickler was originally named the Piper. Harrenhal whore Pretty Pia was originally named Pretty Mia. Zaro Zoandaxis was originally named Jaro Joandaxis. The Greyjoy banner was originally supposed to have three tails streaming from it like the arms of a kraken. And when Renly dies, there's a deleted line in which Catelyn is said to stand still as stone. I'm skeptical that this was meant as a Stoneheart foreshadowing, but the same draft has the line in which Catelyn looks her reflection in some breastplate and sees the face of a drowned woman. So it's possible.
Yeah, that's definitely foreshadowing.
Well, that's definitely foreshadowing of her dying, getting thrown in the river. But who knows about still as stone and Stoneheart.
All right,
and that's it. That's the differences between the what George was doing during Clash.
So the major thing being the glass candles. I don't know if I like that every maester had one, because it kind of reminds me of the chains and the links in the chain about how they always they try to light the glass candle, but it doesn't. It's just a reminder that some of the mysteries out there, not everyone.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think so all the stuff about it being a mystery and like learning a lesson from it, that's in the Crescent prologue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's actually like borrowed from the Clash of Kings and brought back and dumped in. See, it says here, every maester was given a glass candle on the day he took his vow at the Citadel. They were beautiful things and required careful handling, for each was a foot tall, icicle slender, and covered with delicate tracery. Ooh. They were wrought of gleaming obsidian, even to the wick. Dragon glass, the small folk called it, black, brittle, beautiful, and so sharp that many a maester had bloodied his fingers on the candles over the years. Like the chains around their necks, a maester's candle was said to be symbolic. The candle is the wisdom you have learned here in the Citadel, they were told. They are as beautiful as knowledge, as fragile as truth. They are made in the shape of candles to remind you that you must cast light wherever you serve, and they are sharp to remind you that the knowledge can be dangerous. Wise men sometimes grow arrogant in their wisdom, but a maester must be humble. So each morning when you rise, you will try to light your candle. And learn again that even with knowledge, some things are not possible.
Right. And I actually like that, but I don't know.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's really beautifully written.
It is beautifully written, but I don't know if I like the idea of like everyone having a glass candle.
too many glass candles.
I like the idea that they're very rare and just sought after, and only like certain special people have them. So it makes it more unique, kind of like the Palantir from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. One thing about these ideas is, I guess if you have a very superhero idea of George, there's this idea that like George has just so many ideas, and it's an infinite well. And then there's this other kind of things where it's like actually maybe George is struggling. And that he got to a Feast for Crows and he didn't know what to do. So he looked for what cut material he had. And he had this cut material on glass candles and was like, okay, I've got this. Let's get going on this, you know. Versus being, you know, rather than it being something that he always wanted to put in and that, you know, he was just waiting for the right time and delayed it. Could very well be that he'd come up with this thing, he'd cut it because he thought it was a bad idea. And then when Feast for Crows came around, he's like, crap, I need ideas. And he like pulled it out of the trash, you know, essentially pulled his cut stuff and started including it. Because, I mean, he includes text itself, you know, on what the glass candle means, you know. And
I'm going to be very real with you. I don't like the idea that George just needed stuff to put in there. So we went back to the garbage bin and just inserted it in there because he needed stuff to bat out. I want to say that there's a plan. There's been a plan this entire time. I want to believe that. I want to believe that he knows what he's doing instead of stumbling.
I will say that with Feast, I am inclined to agree with you. Like I think with Feast, there was not much padding. I think there is some padding in Dance, but I think you are right. I think you are right, at least especially on the first half, like the first parts of Feast, you know, that these are, it's filled with his ideas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like even if you're claiming like, oh, Brienne is wandering around or whatever, you know, is there really any purpose for her to go to the Quiet Isle and stuff like that? And you're like, okay, but that's near the end, you know, that's near the end of the Brienne story. Like I'll say that with the glass candle, I'll admit that I think he had thought of this and wanted it back, and it wasn't just padding. Tyrion and Volantis, though.
What is it? Tyrion 3, the worst fucking chapter ever.
Tyrion 7.
Tyrion 7.
7. Worst chapter in Ice and Fire. Yeah. Oh.
Okay, so that's the Clash drafts. Next time we will check out the Storm of Swords draft.
Yeah, sounds good.
Which is going to have some Red Wedding stuff. I took a peek. It's going to have some Red Wedding stuff. It's going to have some Night of the Laughing Tree stuff. To let the audience know, I know for a fact Preston was itching to talk about the glass candles. That's his bread and butter right there.
Oh, I mean, I love the glass candles. Glass candles are great. I love the glass candles.
That's it. That's all we got.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.